this case, you have four shiny victims. They're good kids. They're the salt of the earth kind, going to college, you know, just exude innocence. That's when everybody goes the extra mile to get this thing solved. And, you know, it could be their daughter that was murdered. This is the ultimate good versus evil case.
John Moriarty says the Idaho murder investigation of four slain students is an excellent example of modern investigative techniques using DNA, cell phone data, and ubiquitous video surveillance cameras. Moriarty knows so because he used all of them in hunting Texas fugitives wanted for murder and other violent crimes. 28-year-old Brian Koberger, a PhD criminology student, made a brief court appearance on January 5th of 2023 with cuts on his face. Hello, I'm investigative reporter Robert Riggs. In covering criminal investigations, I look for the facts in law enforcement arrest warrants and search warrant affidavits. John Moriarty, the former Inspector General of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, wrote countless numbers of such affidavits during his career. You may recall that the transplanted Irish cop from New York City is featured in my podcast series about serial killer Kenneth McDuff and in our Telly Award-winning television documentary on Fox Nation streaming titled Freed to Kill. We are going to break down the arrest warrant affidavit and what led to the arrest of Brian Koberger, a PhD criminology student and teaching assistant at Washington State University's Pullman campus, 10 miles from the scene of the murders. I am placing a link to the affidavit in the show notes if you want to follow along. Based on our review of the arrest warrant affidavit, we're going to talk about a possible motive for the murders. John, when I read the arrest warrant for Brian Koberger in the Idaho murder case, it really is kind of a blueprint of the best of modern policing using video footage in the area, cell phone data, and DNA. Walk me through for our audience what an affidavit is, because I know you have a lot of time in your career where you wrote these affidavits, but explain why they're necessary and why they are done.
During the course of the investigation, in this case and other cases that I've been involved in, there's hundreds of interviews done. It's like a fire hose of information coming in, and you've got to sort through that if you're managing the case especially and determine what's important and what's not important. And an affidavit is a statement of facts to support a warrant or a search warrant. You know, reading that affidavit, again, they only put in what's relevant to the case to reach the end of a statement of facts that would allow a judge to issue either an arrest warrant or a search warrant for a location.
And in this case, the arrest warrant in the Idaho case, it's a statement by a corporal. But it points out he's assisted by members of the Idaho State Police and agents of the FBI. So it tells me there actually were a lot of contributors to the affidavit.
Absolutely.
So anybody would look at it and went, well, there's this young corporal. Well, they're off base. There's a lot of people putting in for information. Yeah. Now, what it does indicate is that he and his partner arrived on the scene to responding officers, and then they walk him through the scene. And so he gives a narrative about what he is seeing.
Yeah, if I recall, the other officer that's there was an initial responding officer. I think he came later, so they have him, and it sounds to me like he may be in a investigative.
Yes.
Type position. So they're walking them through the scene like they would on a on an arriving detective will always talk to the first in uniform on the scene to go through what he saw, and you know, and the fact that he mentions in the affidavit too that the only thing different was that the dog was removed from one of the rooms. Everything else remained the same.
And he actually had reviewed the body camera footage by the responding officer.
That's correct.
Dog being removed. Now, in this narrative, he talks about arriving at the residence and the responding officer walks him upstairs to the second floor. And he notes as he's headed to a bedroom, he sees the body of Miss Kernodle on the floor of a bathroom. And then as he goes on, he goes into the bedroom and her boyfriend is deceased with wounds. The wounds to Miss Kernodle are described as caused by an edged weapon. But interestingly, the wounds to the boyfriend, who is killed in the other room, were sharp penetration wounds. I'm wondering, what do you think the difference is there? He says sharp force injuries. Stabbing versus what? Cutting?
Cutting, yes. And that's what was visible at the time. Mm-hmm. And I know they make reference also to some of the wounds post-autopsy. They make a reference in the affidavit. But I'm sure that that's just what was visible to him at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would not move those bodies or do anything to alter the scene. No.
Well, he's then led to the third floor, to a bedroom, where two women, two of the roommates, Miss Goncalves and Mogan, are visible in bed with stab wounds. But he notes that he noticed a tan leather knife sheath, laying on the bed next to Miss Mogan's right side, still on the bed, that he could see from the door. And he said it was processed and had a K-bar, U.S. Marine Corps Eagle Globe and Anchor on the outside of it. And that they located, the lab located a single source of male DNA left on the button snap of the knife sheath. So now here's where the DNA comes into play. So key part of an investigation today that in the past you never even thought of, when you think back when you first started your career as a detective.
Yeah. Back then, you know, if you were lucky, you got a similar blood type, you know, at the scene, and that was it. But yeah, DNA is obviously revolutionized, you know, police work. The technology has absolutely changed the way law enforcement handles crime scenes. And I mean, they were always careful around crime scenes, but I give you, for instance, when a case that we had of a guy who was out on parole and he was a suspect of abducting and sexually assaulting a male child. One of the first cases that I was involved in was when the child was recovered, safe, by the way, his face was swabbed and the DNA from the suspect was found on his face. And the second thing you're talking about, well, when we talk about electronics and tracking and phones and that kind of thing. But in this case, this guy was also on a electronic monitor that was live time transmitting 24/7. It showed him the days before. The day before, he had the electronic monitor removed, and the day of the abduction of the child mm-hmm. was the first day he didn't have it on. And we went back and looked at that monitor, and he had been going by that school where that child was abducted from for like 6 or 7 days in a row.
Well, in this case, we'll get into this in a minute, the cell phone tracking data really kind of does the same thing that electronic monitor did.
Exactly.
But let me go to the next step here in the affidavit, he points out that numerous interviews were conducted by Moscow Police Department officers, Idaho State Police detectives, and FBI agents. And I bet you it's in the hundreds, I would guess, in a case like this. But he points out that two of the interviews were of two female roommates that were on the first floor. They only identify them by the initials, their first and last name initials. But and they place the roommates' bedrooms, you know, respective to where the upstairs rooms where the victims were found were. And he then lays out the timeline from the investigation of when Chapin, the male, and his girlfriend Kerr Noodle were last seen. They were at a fraternity house on campus. And then also when Gonclaves and Mogan, the two women found on the third floor, when they were last seen at a corner bar club as well. And so they're bringing down the times. They're narrowing down the times and conclude that from the statements of those two women, that all those occupants, the deceased, were all home by 2 a.m. asleep, or at least in their rooms by 4 a.m. But point out that Kerr Noodle received a DoorDash order at approximately 4 a.m. And, you know, she says she went to sleep, but she was awakened around that time by Concal's playing with her dog. We talked about the dog, one of the upstairs bedrooms.
Right.
Which is on the third floor. And then she said a short time later, she thought Conclave said something to the effect, there's someone here. And they looked at the deceased victim's cell phone, and they found that she was likely awake then, and she was on TikTok at around 4:12 a.m. So they're laying down very specific times. Why is this important to the investigation?
Well, because all of the circumstantial evidence that they're developing places one person, only one person, at that house at that time. Given the facts on, I know the phones were shut off a couple hours, which in itself is a good piece of evidence. It's common that, you know, people do not, when they commit a crime, do not want to be detected by the location of their phone.
Right.
And, a lot of times when we used to track phones, I mean, its accuracy is pretty amazing. And a lot of it has to do, of course, with the phone company itself that you're working with and the technicians that work there. And I mean, there's a lot of we had some very expensive technology that was vehicle mounted that, you know, we could we could track phones and but it's just gets increasingly better all the time. But the what I'm trying to get at is that even though the phone wasn't there, all of these other circumstantial facts, the videos, the DNA, which is not circumstantial, but physical evidence. But, you know, all of that, you know, there's nothing to eliminate him as a suspect either. It's all every piece of evidence that's detailed in that affidavit puts him at that scene.
Yeah, I'm gonna get you there here in a moment. And as we go on with this roommate identified as DM, so she's heard this comment about somebody being in the house. She said she opened the door, didn't see anything. Then she said she opened the door a second time when she heard what she thought was crying coming from Kerr Noodle's room. And she said she heard a male voice say something to the effect, it's okay, I'm going to help you. Right. Around that same time, this really goes to the intensity of the investigation, they note a security camera at the neighbor's place over against the wall of where the victim's bedroom rooms are.
Right.
Picks up distorted audio of what sounds like voices or a whimper followed by a loud thud, And a dog can be barking numerous times. And that's at 4:17 a.m.
Right.
So, you know, we know she got food at 4 a.m. We know she's on TikTok at 4:12. So it appears this stuff is unfolding between 4 and 4:17 in the morning. And then she says, after she heard that crying, she opened the door to her room. This is for a third time. And she saw a figure clad in black clothing and a mask that covered the person's mouth and nose walking towards her. She described him as 5'10 or taller, male, not very muscular, but athletically built with bushy eyebrows.
Right.
And the male walked past her as she stood, quote, in a frozen shock phase. And then the male walked out. And she says she locked herself in her room. And this led the investigators to believe that was the killer leaving.
Right.
So the investigators, you know, when they've looked at the two roommates' records, phone records, and the videos, they, you know, they think the homicides occurred between 4 a.m. and 4:25 a.m. But what has stunned me that this roommate witnesses this, goes back in her room, says she's, you know, frozen. But, you know, later the police aren't there until 4 p.m. This is all at between 4 a.m. and 4:25 a.m. And it's later at 4 p.m. that, you know, you're just like, wow, why didn't somebody call the police? Now, I've heard that that house was known as a party house. So maybe comings and goings, but, you know, she was frozen in fear. What do you make of that?
Well, if you back it up, the other murders of the other two females was done prior to this contact, you know,
yes,
with her.
Yeah.
So this guy, when he passes her in the hall, he's spending some time inside that place and things aren't going the way I believed he had. You know, he had the scenario probably laid out in his head, whatever that scenario was, and it was mayhem. And she would have been a victim, too, if he hadn't already had killed four. And he knew he needed to get out of there. And because time was running short. And the other thing they talk about in the affidavit is there's a situation where the vehicle that he's driving is caught on video leaving at a high rate of speed from the neighborhood. So I think time, you know, he knew that the time was his downfall. He also didn't know how long she was there or what she saw. Did she call anybody? I think, you know, he knew by that time that he needed just to get out of there.
Because I thought he would have killed her after doing this, but he's in a hurry. He's got to get out of there.
That's right. Yeah. I think that's the key, and that's why she survived. I think he was more worried about getting caught than he was about anything else by that time. I mean, as a normal thinking person, you just caused the death of four people or cut up four people pretty badly and didn't know if they were going to die or not. But I mean, I can't imagine that being something that he planned out that way.
Well, they did a video canvas of the neighborhood, which is common now. And, you know, I'm seeing all kinds of cases where suspects are being caught because they're captured on Ring video. There's video all over the place, especially the Ring. I see that all the time. So they find in that video canvas that starting at 3:29 a.m. and ending at 4:20 a.m., the suspect's car is picked up on camera. He's even making, it's like he's checking it out. Because at 3:29 a.m. he's making passes by. So which, when you see that he's coming by, and then I'll go into later, he had actually been coming by months earlier.
Right.
Does that tell you that he had a target? There was something going on there. That house.
Yeah, exactly. I think someone in that house was his primary target. And, you know, that obviously they're not around to ID him or say if they've ever had any contact with him, even if it was briefly at one of these bars. And you don't know, you know, they refer to things, you know, with people that go off as a precipitating stressor, that something happened to make them twist off. And, you know, was he blown off by one of the females when he contacted him? When he may have contacted him at a bar. I mean, you don't know, but it's just highly unusual for this type of thing to happen. I know there's a case where a criminal justice student or tried to get away with the perfect crime. I don't know if that's what you're dealing with here either, but I mean, in today's day and age, the chance of you walking away from a quadruple homicide is almost non-existent.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And the one thing I know from over the years talking with really experienced homicide detectives, you know, some of the same people I do, is that usually the victim knows the perpetrator or they've crossed paths with them somewhere.
Right.
And didn't know.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's typical. It's just not a random, it's very rare that it's random, except in the case of, you know, serial killers that are doing blitz attacks, what have you. Well,
yeah.
One other thing that really impressed me about the forensic abilities and investigations like this is that they took this video footage of the suspect vehicle to forensic examiners at the FBI. You're a graduate of the FBI Academy. And what's so interesting here, they have an expert on identifying cars by unique characteristics. And that expert's got a database that gives visual clues. And, you know, in the beginning, he thought it was a 2011 to 2013 Hyundai Elantra. But once he dug in more, he narrowed it to 2011 to 2016. So then they started reviewing information on people that own that kind of car, white Hyundai, 2011 to 2016. So
right.
Talk for a minute about what you saw at the FBI Academy in their forensics ability they've got there. I know they've got all those facilities there.
Yeah, they're, without a doubt, the FBI crime lab is the world's best, I would say, at their forensic capabilities. They're well-equipped, they're well-trained, they have some of the finest experts in the world, whether it be fiber, DNA, but in this case, it was the Idaho State Police that did the DNA, their crime lab.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of the labs are trained via the FBI also, you know, whether it be tire marks, footprints. I mean, you think of all of the things forensically that can be discovered at a crime scene. The FBI have a way to match that, whether it be the type of tires on the car. It's we can go into a lot of different things, but I know that they found also a footprint at the scene.
Yes.
And
yep.
The affidavit, it talks about it being from a Vans type brand. And I'm sure I'd be shocked if the FBI or the Idaho State Crime Lab didn't have a hand in that identification.
Yeah, they even note it's got a diamond-shaped texture on it.
Right.
And
right.
Then you know that you were eventually run a search warrant. You're going to be looking for that. You're going to be looking for shoes like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, what's interesting here is that the sweep of cameras, I mean, for miles, they're getting cameras. You know, they even get camera footage from a grocery store, and they find him, Brian Koberger, there prior to the, you know, shortly before the murders. They build an entire route of where he's going and stuff. But the other thing that impressed me that 2 days after the murder, they put out a bulletin and they ask area law enforcement to be on the lookout for a white Hyundai Elantra in the area. And a Washington State University police officer, you know, he was really alert, and that's where Brian Koberger was going to college in criminology to work on his PhD. He looked through their database at the university, and he finds a 2015 white Elantra with a Pennsylvania license plate, has the number, shows who it's registered to, Koberger. And the camera footage had picked up that car.
They get his DL, driver's license photo also.
Yeah, and then they're really, I noted that in here. Then they're really rolling with that, you know, because they've got the description, and they note that, lo and behold, he's got big, bushy eyebrows in his driver's license photo.
Yeah. He matches the description of the eyewitness at the house gives him.
Yeah.
Physical characteristics. But now, backing up, Robert, on the store, when he's at the grocery store, my guess on that is that they got a hold of his either debit or credit card and were able to see every place he did purchases. And they went back and pulled video from all of those places, if it was relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was relevant that day because it was 1 o'clock, I believe, around that afternoon, the day of the homicides, the day either before the homicide, I guess. I think, you know, they did such a thorough job. I mean, we're looking at this affidavit, but the only thing that's in there is what's relevant to the crime. I mean, there's a lot of other things that they have in their pocket that they're not talking about quite yet.
Well, once they tie his car to that university, you know, now they're getting all kinds of records about his criminology, what he's doing, his degrees.
The video from the university too was key in him leaving, you know, the residence and prior to the murders and then returning after the murders. And that was all in the affidavits as well.
Right. I was going to get onto that, but that is something, it's the old, you know, it's hard to believe the adage that the killer always returns to the scene of the crime.
Right.
So, you know, he goes back. But what we have this extensive tracking of him by cell phones, his cell phone. And we also know that his cell phone goes off around the time the murders are taking place. Tell us how you used cell phones, because I know you did this in tracking fugitives that had broken out of prison and had been doing it a long time. Without disclosing, and because I know there's some technology and stuff is secretive, walk us through how they do this, how this happens, the triangulation and all that takes place.
Yeah, the first thing obviously is the court order, getting the court order to allow this tracking to be done, because you are intercepting signals. Once you get the court order, you could be sitting in your office in coordination with the phone company. If you're live, you can go live on these with these warrants also. But, you know, historical information is what they're talking about in the affidavit, mm-hmm. which gives you the cell tower, what time that phone was at that tower, when it switched off of the tower onto another one. I mean, you can track that person all across the country. I mean, I had a similar incident where a guy escaped from a maximum security prison, and it was very frustrating because we were live tracking him, and we were reporting to the different state police agencies, you know, he's eastbound on a major interstate. And he traveled all across the country. We were watching him for like 18 hours, and it was driving us crazy because nobody could get him. We knew what the vehicle he was in. We knew direction of travel. We knew location. But again, there's traffic issues. I understand that. But finally, we got him in North Carolina when he checked into a hotel and the signal stopped and the phone was still on. And, you know, the technology's good, but you got to have the ground support also on the thing. But they just talk about historical information on that phone. And he had that phone since June, according to the affidavit. And they went back and got everything, I think, forward from that point on. And that's how they knew we had gone by that residence 12 times, because those cell towers register that phone every time it switches. And how it works is that phone that you're carrying goes to the closest location, the closest cell tower with service, in order to get that the best signal for you as the consumer. And when you travel past that, it switches off to the next tower.
The cell phone data in the arrest warrant affidavit for Brian Koberger indicates he was near the house where the four students lived a dozen times before they were murdered on November 13th of 2022.
I think he was really fixated on somebody in that house. I mean, I don't have any doubt that, I mean, it was just, was it, you know, what was he thinking? Can I commit the perfect crime, or did he have a vendetta or an issue with someone in that house?
You know, and they also mentioned that when they start digging into all these cell phone records, they're getting assistance from an FBI agent that is a certified member of the Cellular Analysis Survey Team, CAST.
Right.
Did you ever work with them or come across them?
Most of the time, we worked with the ESU, the Electronic Surveillance Unit, with the U.S. Marshals Service. They had their Western region or headquarters out of Houston, and we, you know, we had people assigned down there, and you know, they did a tremendous amount of cell phone tracking with fugitives. Whereas with crimes, it's got to be a pretty high level crime to track a cell live, but you know, with major fugitives, it's done quite often, almost every day. I can tell you some incredible stories with the Marshal Service, you know, about tracking phones and sitting in a location, watching a phone, say, live across the country in another city. I mean, it's the Marshals have it going on, too, with the cell phones.
Well, you know, they do indicate in the cellular phone data that at 12:46 p.m. now, the murders are going to occur starting around 4 a.m., but it places him at an Albertson's grocery store, and then they get the surveillance footage in the grocery store, and it shows him getting out of the Elantra. He walks through the store, purchases unknown items at the checkout and leaves at 1:04. I'm thinking that if he used a credit card or debit, they know what he purchased. They're just not saying it here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They know now anyway.
Yeah.
Things are fast and furious when it's going on, you know, the intense scrutiny that they were under, you know, also it wears everybody down too, you know, that's involved, because you're going 24/7. If you're involved in that type of a case, you may go home and get a couple hours sleep and then get back up and get on it, because it's constantly on your mind. You know, it's just, you can't think of anything else.
Yeah, and it's reading between the lines here and studying this, it's clear to me they're tracking his cell phone all the way back to his home in Pennsylvania.
It could be. Yeah, that's a very likely possibility.
And then there were the traffic stops, one for following too closely.
I
never hear of traffic stops for that. So I'm guessing that there were troopers that were given an alert, and they're just trying to keep up with him and see what's going on.
Yeah, just confirm who's in the car.
It's kind of buried here between the lines, but there is a reference of surveillance that's going on. And so it tells me that, you know, they put in the affidavit that on December 27th, they recovered trash from the family residence. But that reference earlier, they must have been sitting on this place watching a lot of stuff. Yeah,
absolutely. They had surveillance teams probably for several days there, just watching his movements. And I know there's also, I can't remember if it's in the affidavit or if it's just in a report that's out there about recovering evidence from neighbors' trash cans.
Yes. Yeah.
That he put, or that actually tied him to the crime.
And there were reports that he had on rubber gloves cleaning the car and taking stuff from the car, putting in the neighbors' trash cans, all of which indicates they were on top of it. They were watching it. Just gathering up the evidence thought he was getting rid of.
You know, the other thing is, you know, everybody said, well, there's surveillance on the house, and everybody's thinking there's guys in cars, you know, driving around or parked nearby, or chances are they didn't take the chance of going to a neighbor since the parents lived there for so long and all of that. My guess is they set up some type of electronic surveillance in the neighborhood to watch the house. And, you know, there's all sorts of things that equipment that's available nowadays to, you know, you can look out your door up and down the street and it'd be empty and they're still watching you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That technology, do you find it's with state police agencies, or is it more of you get it help from the FBI?
You know, the state definitely has it. And just like the cell phone tracking stuff, the state has it. The feds have it. Different agencies. There's numerous different applications. DEA has stuff also. And it's the way business is done nowadays.
So there has been the speculation, was he working on a PhD in criminology to learn how to commit the perfect crime? If that was the case, he gets an F. But what do you think? Because criminology is more, from what I know of, more of sort of theory, not into forensics and details, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I've got a master's degree in criminal justice, and I, you know, I attended university with a lot of people that weren't in the business of law enforcement. And, you know, there's a lot of theory there is. And, you know, there's a lot of development of programs talking about saving people and, you know, helping rehabilitate people. And there is discussion, depending on the class, of course, there is discussion about forensics and its application. But it's, again, it's a lot of it is theory. And yeah, it's good to read about it in a book, you know, but when you're out there and you're practically applying that knowledge, it's completely different. From the timeline on this thing, it's obviously that the females, the two females in the single bed were killed first. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that, which would lead me to believe that one of them may have been, you know, if he had a and he had an issue, it would have been one of them. But, you know, the ability to successfully pull that off in theory with a K-bar knife, I just can't imagine. You know, I understand maybe, the motive. We don't know what else he went there with. As they say in the business, you know, did he show up with a rape kit besides the knife? Mm-hmm. Did he have things to tie him up? Did he, you know, to tie up whoever? Did he think he was just going to confront or one female and there were two in the bed? I mean, there's a lot of unknown questions that the police, I think, that are investigating have the answers to.
Well, speaking of the police, you know, they played their cards close to the vest during this. They got some criticism for it. Talk about the pressure they would have been under in other agencies like them in high-profile cases, because you've been there. I remember you led the manhunt across the country for the Texas Seven, the seven inmates who broke out of prison, were doing robberies, and then murdered a police officer on Christmas Eve in Irving.
That's right. Yeah. The case takes on a life of its own, and you're just getting deluged with tips and information and the media. You know, I'll never forget one of the things that happened during the 7 was we were getting media calls from New York that they had evacuated this block because they had a sighting and you know, we were sure that these guys didn't go to New York City just because, and we knew that they were going to stay together by the profile we had on them. You get all of that. You've got all the media calling. You've got, as soon as you walk out the door of whatever building you're in, where, you know, we had a headquarters operation set up in Huntsville and had massive electronic surveillance going on phones all over the country. We took up a whole floor, second floor. I think it was the largest electronic surveillance operation in the history of Texas at the time. And, you know, the media wants up to the minute information. Well, you got to have your holdbacks. And these guys, I thought, did an outstanding job of no leaks, you know, no information put out that didn't need to go out. There may have been some flubs on, you know, not being a continuing threat to the community when they first said that. It definitely, to me, I agree with them. It appeared that it was a targeted crime. Just the pressure on those guys is just incredible. You just can't, I don't think, unless you live through it, you don't understand it. And I think they did an outstanding job. And I think there's going to be a lot more coming out at the trial that shows their professionalism, both, you know, the state police, the local police, and the FBI. I think it was a well-coordinated effort that resulted in a great arrest. And you know, I'm sure by now, you know, they had his father's DNA from that trash pickup that you mentioned.
Yes.
And I'm sure they've gotten a warrant that's probably sealed also for his DNA to complete the match on that K-bar knife snap.
Yes. Yes. Well, based on your experience, I know years undercover, then years supervisory and then head of the inspector general in Texas in the criminal justice system, and going through the FBI Academy, sum up for me what kind of job, based on what we read in this affidavit, you think all the investigators have done.
You know, when you talk to homicide guys and you're around people that are murderers, and they talk about shiny victims, okay? And in this case, you have four shiny victims. They're good kids. They're the salt of the earth kind, going to college, you know, just exude innocence. That's when everybody goes the extra mile to get this thing solved. And, you know, it could be their daughter that was murdered. This is the ultimate good versus evil case. And that's, you know, that's where everybody works together. Everybody, you know, it's not, you're not out there to get the gold star pinned to your chest. You're out there to contribute to the team. And that's what I think I saw from the distance, that it was a very, very positive, concerted effort, which came to a incredibly great conclusion. Now the prosecutors have got to pick up the ball and run with it.
Indeed, prosecutors have asked anyone with any information about Koberger to come forward. Based on our experience, Moriarty and I believe that anyone who murders four people in a single act has likely killed before or committed other violent crimes as they progress to murder. We'll have more insights into the Idaho murder case as the evidence comes to light. I'm Robert Riggs of True Crime Reporter. True Crime Reporter is written by me, Robert Riggs. It is produced and researched by Siler Burr. You can read more about our team on our website at truecrimereporter.com. And while you're there, please sign up to join our true crime community. It's free. There's a red box on every page to receive our free email updates with behind-the-scenes information. And you can email your suggestions to fan@truecrimereporter.com. I read all of them. This podcast is a trademarked and copyrighted news organization based in Dallas, Texas. Thanks for listening to our Journey into Darkness.